Good afternoon, everyone, or good evening, wherever you are. I'm in Santa Fe, where a monsoon has just struck, which is the most water I've seen since May. So anyway, if I disappear, I would like to introduce you to Samantha Downing and Robin Harding, who they tell me have read each other's books. So in the absence of me, they'll be able to carry on with our afternoon or evening event. So this is Samantha's book. I love it. A Twisted Love Story. And it really is. Love the colors. And Robin's book right over here, which is gorgeous. The Drowning Woman is a completely different color palette. Wow. That's interesting. You know, how that, did you guys have any input at all into your covers?
Yeah, I always, I had a bit of input into the color of the font, that how it sort of mimics the sunset. That was sort of my suggestion. But luckily in this case, I really love the cover right off the bat.
Well, and it needs to have that kind of sunset seaside look, as we will determine. So, Samantha, how about you? Are you happy with this color palette? I know you don't really want to say no since we're live. But...
No, I am. We went through a few different covers trying to blend the thriller aspect and the love story aspect, which is hard to get in the same cover. This one, I really love the movement of it, that somebody is grabbing the rose and crushing it, and the petals are sort of blurry because they're falling. So it has the sensation of movement on it, which I really like.
Yeah, no, it's very, it grabs you. And by the way, thank you for the kind words and your acknowledgement. That was very kind of you.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you for all that you do.
I appreciate it. One of these days, we're going to actually get you to the store. I haven't determined how we're going to do that. And actually, to be fair, I canceled May Cobb because it was 119 for her live appearance on the day. And I wasn't sure they weren't going to close the airport. It's 119 today in Scottsdale. So I wouldn't have wanted you to come right now.
Right. I am in. Well, it will be easier for me next time because I just moved from New Orleans to California. So I'll be able to. I just moved a month ago and I'm in Northern California. So not very far.
But if your book is in July, you still may want to rethink the live part. Right. So here we are, Robin's in Canada, I might add. So oblivious to the UPS strike. Probably.
Yeah, I didn't. I mean, I would assume they're on strike here too. I haven't heard. Our ports are on strike. That's our big thing.
So I read, Robin wrote a really nice essay in Crime Reads and listed some books about complicated relationships that she thought were worth our attention. But both of you, this was a pairing made by your publishers, presumably on the basis they thought your books were sufficiently similar that you could talk to each other. But what you're actually examining in both of them are personal relationships, a pair, but then other people involved. So it's not just the pair, but it's more people. What is it that drives you both to want to look into, to investigate relationships as opposed to chasing a serial killer or a spy or whatever? Samantha, you know, what is it that fascinates you with that?
Well, I think in the sense of a thriller, one of the scariest things we have in life is the people we're closest to betraying us. And in every thriller, there's a betrayal of some kind. And in this type of thriller, a relationship thriller or domestic thriller or whatever we're calling it these days, it's the people closest to you that betray you. And you're right, in this case, the book is about a couple, but it's also about all the people that have something else, something to say about the relationship or something to do about the relationship, because we always think a couple is two people, but it never really is. There's family, there's friends, everybody wants a say in what you should do and what have you. So all of that is incorporated into it.
Did you read Megan Abbott's June book by chance?
The most recent one?
Yeah.
No, I haven't read the
most
recent
one. I'm drawing a blank on the name. It'll come to me in a minute.
Beware the woman.
That's it. Thank you very much. Which has been billed as a gothic, and that would be fair. But the true crucial, we did an event with her, and the two big questions that the book asks are, one, do you really know the person you married or in a relationship with? Do you really know them? But then I thought a really great question that she raises is, what do you owe if you're in a relationship, if you're a child, what do you owe to your parents? Or if you're a parent and you're in a relationship, what do you owe to your child? Or you can expand that to other members of your family? And, you know, I think those are really important questions in this, you know, relationship. I don't like domestic thriller much. I think relationship thriller maybe is a, I like it anyway. I think those questions are so important, and that's really what you're building the books on. All right, Robin, your thoughts?
Yeah, I was going to address what you said earlier, that I actually like chased Sam down to do an event with me because I'm such a fan of her books, and we, you know, our books came out fairly close together. And she is such a master of handling particularly romantic relationships, I think. I mean, you've done other things too, Sam, but, you know, My Lovely Wife was just so mind-blowing, and I think A Twisted Love Story is so in that vein and has that vibe that I love so much. And I feel like my books, I have done romantic relationships, but I do a lot more friendship and family, I think. You know, the relationships, how things go wrong within a family, or in this case, it's a friendship that's gone wrong. So, and I often do deal with friendships between women, because I think those can be extremely close and extremely fraught and difficult. And, you know, drama between two close friends is as painful and devastating as it is between partners sometimes, romantic partners. So I have a lot of fun playing around in that area.
It's interesting you say that, because I'm not sure that they were ever really friends, at least any kind of honest friends, but
right.
There's a lot of potential spoilers in this book. Yeah. It's gonna be really hard to talk about it. Since you've read each other's books, it'd be great if you talk to each other, but why don't you each give just a little tiny pitch, so to speak? What would you describe your book as, Samantha, in your own words?
I would say A Twisted Love Story is about a couple, Wes and Ivy, who have had a 10-year on and off relationship, and they are basically a tornado. They barrel through life doing their thing, and other people get caught up in their whirlwind of drama. And some people insert themselves into the whirlwind of drama. And the more dramatic they get, the more consequences there are, including death. So at the beginning of the book, a detective has caught on to this couple and thinks something is going on there. And that's where the story starts.
So do you think that in a relationship like that, it's always going to escalate? I mean, you can't really just keep the pot simmering at the same level.
Wes and Ivy are in love with falling in love. Every time they break up and get back together, they fall in love all over again. It just takes something more dramatic for it to happen each time. A little bit like an addict needs more of whatever they're addicted to each time to feel the same thing. So in their case, definitely they have to get more dramatic in order to feel what they want to feel and have their big reconciliation and then do it all over again.
Spencer Quinn has a wonderful book coming out called Mrs. Plansky's Revenge. You might have read about it. And at one point, the elderly mom, who's about to be defrauded of her life savings by the guy in Romania, has to confront her 40-ish daughter, who is bringing home, having been divorced thrice, her new boyfriend. And at the end, she says, looking at the couple, she thinks to herself, Nina is in love with love. Matthew is in love with himself. And I thought, God, that was so brilliant. I was just like, wow, summed it up. So in a way, it's kind of what you're saying.
Exactly. And I also just want to say about Robin, thank you for chasing me down for this event. I'm a huge fan of your books. And I'm just going to say very briefly.
I thought.
Oh, no, she froze.
I thought it was me because the lightning is just crashing away out there. Jacob, if you're listening, you may need to bring Samantha back in again. You know, the weather is just hell for all this, but right. So while we've lost her, Robin, I wanted to say that I never really considered, even though I read Nickel and Dimed in America, I never really considered how horrible it would be to be homeless, to spiral down and basically live out of your car until I read this book, and I was really moved by that and thought, you know, what grit it would take to do that.
Yeah.
There she is. You're back.
Sorry about that. This no is problem. Why I have two internet connections in my house, because one of them inevitably goes out. So I just want to say, I love Robin for being so risky, and she takes chances that other writers don't take. And I admire that so much, because it has so much potential to go wrong, and she never goes wrong with it. So it works perfectly.
I feel the same about you. You're so brave, and it's so much fun to read your books. I love them.
Thank you.
I have to admit that when I started Robin's book, I had absolutely no idea where it was going to go. I kind of knew where yours might go, or at least, you know, was going to go. But with Robin, I'm going, what is happening here? Wow. So do you want to do a little, we were talking about how moving her portrait of being homeless is, and how really educational it was, you know, to read about how you would try to live if you were sleeping in your car, and you know, how hard it would be to take a shower, whether you could ever brush your teeth, you know, what would you do about laundry? How do you smell? What do you eat? You know?
How do you feel about yourself? Which was one of the biggest things I learned through talking with homeless advocates and stuff about, you know, how much it changes who you are when you live that way, and so much is stripped away from you. But if you wanted me to give a little quick synopsis. So yeah, it's about a woman who was a successful restaurateur named Lee, and she lost everything after the pandemic and is forced to live in her car. And she's feeling very vulnerable. So she is parking near the ocean in this very wealthy neighborhood surrounded by cliffside mansions. And she's sleeping in her car one pre-dawn morning, and she hears one of these wealthy society wives trying to drown herself in the ocean. And just on instinct, she rushes in and saves her life, pulls this woman out of the ocean. And this unlikely friendship forges between these two very different women. And one day the wealthy woman, whose name is Hazel, asks Lee, the homeless woman, to help her disappear. And all is not as it seems in Hazel's gilded cage, nor is it in Lee's homeless life. So it gets twisted.
There are men involved. We do have
to. And there are men involved.
Yep. So even though this might be two women, they are not immune to men.
Yes.
Right. Okay. So Robin, why don't you talk to some, or kick it off? Why don't you two talk to each other? Because I imagine you have questions that you'd like to address.
I would love to know, Robin, if you are a pantser, do you plot your books or do you not plot your books?
I plot them like roughly. I use screenplay structure, and I plot the big turning points, but I don't like outline extensively. I was talking to Wendy Walker, and she said her outlines are, you know, like 40 pages long. Like, she knows every single chapter. I just know the big plot beats. What about you?
I was going to say, Ashley Winstead is a plotter like that. I talked to her. She's one of those 40 page plotters. I'm a complete pantser from start to finish.
Really?
I never know anything that's going to happen. I just start and I just go and start writing.
Oh, so what do you start with?
It depends. Sometimes it could be a story idea, sometimes a character. And it doesn't always work. I mean, I could write 5, 10, 20,000 words and realize this is not a book. This is an idea is not a book. A premise is not a book. It has to be turned into a book, or I just don't like it and I throw it out. So it's the most inefficient way to write, for sure. But that's what I do. So that's how it goes.
Wow. And how has your pub week been so far?
Hectic, anxious, yeah. Exciting, all the things. So I'm in a new state, obviously, still trying to get settled. So everything is more discombobulated than usual. But, you know, it is what it is. So here we are. And I just am glad it's out. You know, we know how long it takes for a book to be published. And we both probably finished writing these over a year ago.
Yeah.
So how did you come up with the idea for this book? Was there something that inspired it?
Well, this was like sort of a big shift for me, this book, because I had I was out without a contract after the pandemic, things had shifted in my career. And I was like, I just want to write something that I really want to write. And I want to take some huge chances. I wanted to use a different kind of structure than I had done in the past. And so, you know, I always say I start with a premise, but this one, honestly, I won't even tell you. It's so boring, like how I got to this. Like it was so, how it like meandered for so long to finally get to this place where two strangers would, you know, connect in such a shocking and crazy way. And then for it to blossom into this very toxic kind of relationship. So all I knew really was that I wanted to use the part one structure from Lee's point of view and the part two structure from Hazel's point of view and address those same issues when knowing what's going on behind the scenes, like follow the same timeline, and then part three and part four. So that was kind of all I knew, was that I wanted to try something new. And then it all just kind of came together. What about you? Because this one is sort of almost felt like a return to your roots of My Lovely Wife a little bit, right? Except with the external forces are more at play, I guess.
Yeah, I wanted in this book, I wrote a book during the height of lockdown, and I threw it out. It was terrible. But there was a small part of it that was about, that had a roller coaster relationship in a subplot. And that kind of grabbed me. And I thought, my goal with this book, my writing goal with the script book, was to make the relationship a character. Because Wes and Ivy are individuals, but when they come together, they become something else. And that relationship has its own characteristics. And that relationship between the two of them is what drives the whole story. And that was the writing goal of it, was to try to have the reader understand what they were doing, whether you agreed with it or didn't agree with it, or whatever your opinion of it was, to understand why they were doing it.
Right.
And then, there's a whole thing called folie à deux, which you know is French for crazy together. And you know, it shows up with occasional serial killers or young couples that, they would not singly, if they had not come together, they would not have acted in the way that they act when they fuel each other. When I was an undergraduate at Stanford, hilariously, somebody started a vineyard up in Napa Valley called Folie à Deux. I was trying to decide whether that meant that they were going to kill each other or whether they thought that starting a vineyard was insane,
crazy,
that they wouldn't have each done separately or what. But I mean, it's a fairly well recognized,
psychological.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And I thought you understood that really well with this couple, that, it took the two of them to create the havoc and that they would never have done either singly or maybe with some other partner.
Exactly. And that was really just what I was going for in the book. And then turn the relationship into a thriller, right? Literally a thriller about a relationship. And just come at it from a different angle than I had done it before, or that I had seen been done before.
So they had to do something riskier than start a vineyard. They had to maybe
right?
tell somebody.
Right. And they couldn't become serial killers because I already did that. So
I know. You've been reading the coverage about the guy on Long Island. I'll tell you, it reads, it'd be hard to make up a thriller that had any more interesting clues and twists in it than New York Times, because it's a local story, has really been developing it. Anyway, I digress. But back to Robin. So did you know that they had to be that desperate when you first conceived of these women? Because they really are both desperate, and they weren't desperate that things would not have developed the way they did.
Yeah. So I was very much moved by, we were all affected by the pandemic, but certain groups were much more impacted than others, certain industries and low income people and marginalized people and women across the board were impacted more. And because I read statistics that female owned businesses were more likely to fail, Rates of anxiety and depression were higher in women, and domestic abuse went sky high for against women and, you know, children as well. But so I wanted to create two women who had been changed by this. I didn't want to write, you know, a pandemic book, but I think we've all come out of this different than we were. I mean, the whole world is different. And I wanted two women who were impacted in very different ways, but were changed, you know, by what they've gone through. And yeah, they are both at the end of their rope, because Hazel is in a very abusive relationship. And, you know, she's basically trapped in her home, and Lee doesn't have a home. So I thought the juxtaposition of these two characters was really something interesting to explore, and bringing them together and the sort of on off, do we trust each other kind of relationship that they have. They may not, but they need each other in the end, because they're both in such terrible circumstances.
Right. So the homeless question has become increasingly, and it's not just in the US, because I remember going to the Toronto VoucherCon in 2019, and I insisted on staying down at the, I'm trying to remember the hotel. It wasn't a convention hotel, so I had to walk every night back and forth. And I kept stepping over bodies, you know, in sleeping bags. It was quite cold.
Vancouver is really bad, because we have the warmest climate in the country. And we have a neighborhood called the Downtown East Side, which is the worst neighborhood in the country. And it is honestly, it's the saddest thing you've ever seen. There's just open drug use. There's people, I mean, it's just, you know, it's just, it's really, really awful. And it's really, really sad. And it became much, much worse after the pandemic.
So part of your quest with your heroine, sorry, I'm going blank on the Lee. Part of the quest, I'm so old, names just go in and out, butterflies. Part of the deal with Lee was she doesn't want to do that. She doesn't want to descend into a homeless camp. She doesn't want to sell herself, you know, for a few quick bucks to fix her current. She's trying to maintain a level of dignity and integrity despite the circumstances, which is what drives her to find this relatively safe place to park.
And, she's afraid, right? So I think a lot of women, you know, I did research into being homeless for women specifically, and they're not comfortable going to shelters, like they, or sleeping in a tent on the street or what have you. They're like, they did an interview here recently, and 100% of self-identifying women on the streets have suffered sexual abuse, sexual violence. So, you know, you don't want to go. She doesn't want, like, that car is everything to her, because it's, you know, a little bit of safety. And, you know, in the first chapter, that proves to not be as safe as she thinks it is. So that's how she's, you know, driving to this, why she's driving to this very she neighborhood and sleeping amongst the mansions and hoping no one chases her away.
Well, surprised the neighborhood didn't have better security, but nonetheless, it's kind of like, you know, a problem. Samantha, why don't you give us a profile of Ivy? Because I would not say that safety was the foremost thing on her mind.
No, not at all. Ivy grew up on a marijuana farm up in very northern part of California, Humboldt County, where they used to grow all the marijuana in the country. And her parents had a little family marijuana farm. And she was used to a lot of chaos as a kid. There were raids, there were helicopters overhead. They would do, neighbors would get arrested. Kids would have to stay with them, or she would have to stay with kids. Even after marijuana is legal, as is in the book, there's so many regulations on it and environmental restrictions that if you're growing it illegally, they're still gonna come after you. So, she had a very chaotic upbringing, and now works and went to college, and now works in corporate America at a very boring job, which is clearly not enough for her. And she spends her time learning languages, and because she gets so bored at work and is constantly trying to learn a new language. So the chaos that she grew up with, it really comes out with Wes. She's very impulsive and really tries to think before she acts, but impulsiveness gets the best of her a lot of the time, especially when the emotions are heightened. So she was a very fun character to write. And when her and Wes are together, they had such a chemistry to me. They knew each other so well after 10 years. They knew exactly how to push each other's buttons and how to get under each other's skin. And they did it every time. they would just go for it because it's exactly what they loved.
So who's Wes? We've talked about Ivy and we've talked about women in Robin's book, but who's the guy?
Wes comes from the Midwest and moved to California for college, grew up in a strict household where he wasn't allowed to do much. So he learned to sneak out in order to have some fun in high school. And he meets Ivy in college and is immediately taken with her. And as soon as he screws up and she tries to break up with him, he tries to win her back and he has to get very dramatic in order to do it. And finally, that's what wins her over. And the stage is set right there for the drama that is, if he screws up again, he's going to have to get more dramatic to win her back. And they're off and running. So he is not as impulsive as she is, but he is just as dramatic.
There's a lot of adrenaline flowing in this book, isn't there?
I had a question about Wes and Ivy. I can. So were you ever at all influenced by these famous volatile couples like Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, or even like Johnny Depp and Amber Heard, very famous, but very famously toxic relationships?
Not so much the thing about Wes and Ivy that's different is they love it just the way it is. They aren't claiming the other one is abusive. They aren't trying to get out of it. They aren't trying to escape.
So more Burton and Taylor then.
Probably more Burton and Taylor. Than Amber and Johnny or some of the other Tommy Lee and Pamela and some of those other ones where they really have decided that's not for them. They aren't, Wes and Ivy aren't like that. This is exactly what they want.
Yes.
Correctly or incorrectly. And I don't use the word toxic. I still don't really understand what it means because I seem to get a lot of different definitions of it. So we specifically titled it A Twisted Love Story so that readers could decide for themselves what it is. Is it terrible? Is it good? Is it toxic? Is it abusive? Completely up to the readers to decide. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to label it for you. Think what you want to think about them. Yeah. Hate them, love them, whatever.
And it was so interesting how the menace in their relationship comes from someone who just doesn't understand it.
Do you see it as kind of a snapshot of their, I mean, if this is a relationship that's going to endure, do you, or is it, well, we can't talk about that, but let's say, you know, you assuming that, or does the reader assume that they're going to just kind of carry on? I mean, Robin's book, there's a resolution and a, you know, kind of new beginning at the end. But what do you see happening with Wes and Ivy?
I think, without giving any spoilers, I think no matter what happens, they are perfect for each other. And that's what I believe about them. I do not believe they should break up. I do not believe that they are bad for each other. I believe the other one gives them exactly what they want, regardless of what anybody else thinks.
So maybe we should sterilize them.
Maybe.
Or he gets a jerk every
time. Maybe. Right. But Robin, I'm wondering about your characters and whether you have, do you use real people as your inspiration? Do you take characteristics from real people? Do you base them on real people? Or are they amalgamations of real people? Or are they completely fiction in your head?
I always feel like there is a kernel of somebody I know, or even myself or something, but I feel like, you know, by the time you build them out and think about their backstory and who they are and why they are the way they are very fictional, but I do connect always with my characters. I connect them to somebody I know, or even sometimes it's just somebody I know of, you know, like somebody I've seen in the media or somebody, you know, that you see a lot of, and then develop it into something. Because I feel like, God, I'd be way too scared to use somebody I really knew. Plus, really, let's be honest. Luckily, not people I know are not that interesting. Not in that way, right? Not in a dangerous kind of way. They're interesting. They're good people. So what about you?
Yeah, they're never based on real people. There might be like a habit I use that somebody has, an interesting right. habit or a way of speaking or something that I might use, but they're never like actual right. people.
Yeah. So. Or sometimes they'll have like a world view of somebody I know, you know, like they view the world a certain way. And I'll be like, that's a bit like, you know, so and so. But then all the other aspects of them are different. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So is an attraction for writing these kinds of books for you the fact that it's not a series, it's a complete story. Everybody in it is in jeopardy, you know, and when you come to the end, it's the end of their story. You're not generally, most books like this don't have sequels using the same characters. Occasionally you could. I remember talking to Lisa Jewell last year, and her book last year was in fact a sequel to an earlier book.
Right, yeah.
And she said she'd never do it again. You know,
really?
She just, no. And I mean, there were some things that from the earlier book that she could explore legitimately in a sequel, but it was almost like a prologue. The first book then became more like a prologue rather than, you know, the second book being a sequel. The first book was more like a prologue. But, you know, do you like that? Do you like both of you? Do you like to be able to throw all these people into, you know, whatever mix it is and, you know, however it comes out, that's their story. And then you can do something else. Samantha, is that how you like to draft your books?
Well, I do, because in my books, it's pretty hard to tell who's the villain and who's the hero, or if any, right. they're all shades of gray. So in my mind, anybody can die, and people yeah. definitely die. So it can be the main character. It could be
right.
any character in the book. And so that option is, oh, I don't do it in every book, but that option is always open in my mind that any of these characters can die because they're not going to live beyond this. They're not going to be in another book, and there's not going to be another story about them.
Yeah. And I like to wrap things up. And I think I might get bored if I had to continue. Like, I love the part of coming up with fresh characters and a fresh scenario, premise, and a whole new setting. I mean, that's what's exciting, I think. And if you know, when people do these 5, 10, what's Lord of the Rings, how many books are in that? I mean, you know, or even Harry Potter, like doing the same, obviously you're coming up with new plots, but I don't know, I feel like that might get boring.
You know, it can go both ways. Basically, when you're writing the sorts of books you're writing, you're doing world building every time you write a book.
Yeah.
Starting at zero, you know, and of course that's the whole thing in fantasy and science fiction, you know, it's how good is the world building. With the series, you've already built the world, and then in many cases you're kind of imprisoned in it, you know, because you can't go back and change. Laurie King once said to me that writing your first book in a series is like packing a suitcase for a trip, you know, you put stuff into it and all, but you know, you can't go back and repack it later, change their age, change their, you know, and some people start out on a course, like Michael Connelly decided to age, you know, Harry Bosch in real time, or Ian Rankin decided to age, going blank here. And then they can't reverse that. And so they write, the series basically writes itself out at some point. Whereas the way you're writing, you know, everything's new, everything's fresh, but it is a lot of work to do world building. So it would depend on, I think, how interesting and easy that is for you, obviously. So didn't you say, Robin, that this was a new beginning, or sort of you were wanting to change things up by writing this book, The Drowning One?
Yeah, I wanted to write in a different structure. So I've written, I mean, this was my 12th book. So, you know, I want to be interested as well. I want readers to be interested, and I want to keep myself interested. So I, you know, change perspective sometimes. You know, I always have to have obviously an exciting premise, but the way I told this story was different. So it's not, yeah, it was just, it's a structure I'd seen used on in films and in TV a bit, but I hadn't really read many books that employed it. So I wanted to, try something new, and I'm glad I did. I'm happy with how it turned out.
Yeah, I don't think you could have had, this book would not have been this book if you hadn't chosen to do that.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Yeah. So Samantha, what do you, you know?
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I try to do, I get bored as well. So I've had, just if you look at my four books, there are two written in first person, two written in third person, two from one point of view, two from multiple points of view. I constantly have to challenge myself and think, what am I going to do this time differently? I would get so bored just writing the same structure every time or the same way every time. There are Easter eggs in my books. So if you were really, really well versed in every little detail, you would see there are links between all the books. There are town names that are mentioned more than once. They're not linked in a biological way or in a big way, but there are slight mentions that appear in each one. But it only if you really remembered all the details from that book you read a year ago would you notice it. So, but it makes it fun for me to do. I remember Bret Easton Ellis and Jay McErnie used to do that with their books. They used to have each other's characters appear in their books. It would just be at a party and somebody's name would pop up and it would be somebody from the other person's book.
Oh, that's fun.
And it was great. Wow. It was fun as a reader to see that,
Sometimes I remember Steve Barry is a good friend of James Rollins, whose real name is Polish. And so when Steve wrote his Polish book, two or three books back, the main character in Poland was actually Jim in his Polish name. So you had to know what that was. But that was a lot of fun because they both, you know, have large fan bases. It was a lot of fun for their fans to figure that out. So what about choosing the tense? You know, you've talked about points of view and all, but, you know, do you like shuffling up, you know, present tense, past tense, whatever it is?
I do. Sorry. Go ahead, Sam.
No, go ahead. I was going to say, do you? I was trying to remember the tenses in your books.
Yeah, I do. So this one is first person present. I've done third person past. I think I've done all of them. I think I've done it all. It's funny. It's just sort of how the story comes to me. It'll come to me in a voice, like the first few lines or the first, you know, you're playing around with the first chapter and you're thinking, okay, what feels natural, how to tell this story. Right. And so I'm very flexible in that way. I did an event with Lisa Jewell as well. And she said, third person for thrillers, first person for women's fiction. Like, she was very, you know, set on her voices and the way she wrote. But it, for me, it just sort of comes to me in a, you know, in a storytelling style, and that's what I go with.
What about you, Samantha?
All of mine have been in present tense. Whether they're first person or third person, I've always written in present tense. Partly because of the immediacy of it for a thriller, partly because, but it does constrain you in a way because the character doesn't know what happens next. So they can't use any sort of foreshadowing because they don't know what, they can't say, oh, I shouldn't have walked through that door because they haven't walked through the door yet. In present tense. So it's limiting in certain ways. But actually right now what I'm writing is in past tense. So that's new for me. So to try to utilize it a different way to try to tell the story and say, okay, I'm going to tell you this story, but we should never have done this kind of a thing or whatever. And then it's in past tense. Yeah. So we'll see how it goes.
Yeah. So what is next for you, or when is next?
I don't know. It depends on, you know, as a pantser, it depends on how fast I can get it done. So I don't have I don't have a date right now.
Okay. Are you far enough in that you don't have to throw it away?
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, I say that, but there's a danger point that, you know, you would get to where you might at one point, you know, have to make a decision. Either I go forward or I say nope.
Yeah. Well, I finished a book in at the end of last year and it's already been thrown out. So that was a complete book. And so sometimes it happens and that's just the way it goes. So I say it with somewhat confidence now. I'm feeling pretty good about this one.
I always hope that people who listen to these programs recognize that there is no one way to write. And, you know, I'm always fascinated when readers ask questions like, you know, what's your schedule? And, you know, do you write on a computer or whatever it is? And there really isn't any transferences there from one author to another. I mean, what works for you is what works for you, but wouldn't necessarily work for anybody else. And I often think that authors get imprinted sort of like puppies, you know, but whatever you did that worked the first time is what you sort of stay with, you know, because it's pretty scary to suddenly bring. Some people do. I mean, some people really do make a change, but I find that most authors write the way their process is, whatever their process was.
Yeah. I feel like my process has really evolved though. Like I started out writing at the time, it was so long ago, it was called Chick Lit, which would now be called Pom-Poms. Right. But this was back in the Bridget Jones's Diary, Confessions of a Shopaholic era. And I used to pants those books. I would just sit down and have like a bit of an idea and I'd just bang it out and I'd be laughing the whole time, you know, just having fun with it. And then when I went to the dark side with the party, then I realized like I felt like I had to be, and I'd done a bunch of screenwriting in between. So I'd done the rom-coms and then I was working in screenwriting and it's so focused on structure that I think when I went back to novels, I was used to that. I was used to plotting things out and like plotting them out was such a collaborative thing. Like it wasn't just myself, like in the screenplay world, I'd have a manager and a producer all, you know, weighing in on every beat of a story. So I kind of had that in my head. And I've been doing that now ever since I started writing thrillers.
So it took a significant change for you to change your style.
Yeah.
Right. So before we get to questions, Samantha, if you were going to sell somebody Robin's book, what would you say? How would you do it?
I would say it is suspenseful, dark, page-turning, thought-provoking, and staggering.
I agree with staggering. Staggering is so true. It's so frustrating not to be able to tell you the big reasons why we love books that we talk about them in these programs. It doesn't work. So Robin, if you were going to sell Samantha's book to somebody, what would you do?
I would say, twisted and twisty, insightful and dark and sexy and definitely thought-provoking. Like it's morally gray, and overall it's extremely entertaining.
I agree. And provocative. I definitely
provocative. Think that's the word I was looking for instead of
keyword. I can't remember names, but I'm pretty good at adjectives. So let's bring Jacob. Well, I'm sorry, before Jacob comes up, is there anything else that you would like to say either about your own book or about each other's books that we have uncovered?
I think it's all good. Thank you.
You're okay. All right. Jacob, come join us and see if we have any response from the audience. I love this magical part here where the screen dissolves, assuming he's actually still there paying attention. Maybe it's, there he is. I love it. Hey, Jake.
Hey, you guys got a few questions here on Facebook. Let's see. Most of these, I think, or all of these can be for both of you. How do you keep yourself motivated to write?
Why don't we start with alphabetically? Why don't we have Samantha answer and then Robin, and that way we don't all look blankly at the screen.
Okay. Well, typically it's because the story comes to me and then I want to tell it. I genuinely enjoy writing. I enjoy sitting down and actually discovering the story. If you don't enjoy writing and you don't want to sit down and do it, it's really not the place to be, because you have to spend a whole lot of hours sitting down writing. So I did it for 20 years before I was published. I wrote, and My Lovely Wife was the 12th book I ever wrote. So I was writing before I was published. And if my publishing journey ends tomorrow, I'm still going to be writing books.
This, of course, raises the question of where are the other books, and are they going to be revived or are they just trashed?
Yeah, they weren't even all thrillers. They were all different genres. It was just me exploring and finding my way, and came full circle back to thrillers, which was primarily what I read.
Interesting. Yeah, I feel the same. I have a lot of creative energy, and my brain never stops thinking about stories and things, you know, stories I want to tell. And I love writing too. So much more than like cleaning or like, what else am I going to do? Right? Like, I'm very fortunate. I've been writing full time for a long time, and I just handed in my next manuscript, and I'm in that awkward stage where I'm like, I don't know what to do. What should I do? Like, you know, I'll walk my dogs and I'd like dusted, and you know, I'll clean my office, and then I'm like, okay, now I want to get back. I want to write. I love writing. Publishing, that part can be harder on me, but the writing itself, I am completely hooked.
Jacob?
Right. This one says, which book of your own did you really love creating? Which book was your favorite to write, I guess is the question.
My favorite is always the one I'm writing right now. So every book I want to be better, every book I want to be better written, everything. So every book, whatever book I'm working on right now, is the one I'm most excited about. And in my head, I think this is the one. I don't know what that means, but I think this is the one. And then the next one will be the one.
Yeah, I think I'm the same in the moment, but I will say that probably The Drowning Woman was one of my most enjoyable writing experiences, because I was trying something new. And also I wasn't under a contract. So I didn't have an editor in place at the time. I didn't have a deadline. I felt a lot more freedom, like to take chances and go places I may not have gone. Like, I already know that if I had been under my previous contract, it would have gone in a much more expected direction, because I knew what my editor liked and I knew what she wanted from me, and I would have had a deadline, and this allowed me the freedom to just do something, take it, you know, zig when I would have zagged and tried something and new. So it was a really, really fun book to write, and I'm proud of it.
It's a little bit scary, and I'm not at liberty to mention the writer, but a very good one who's had a long series and a lot of contracts told me on our last event together that it was the last book the author was going to write under contract, because it was an obligation. And because the contract was an obligation, it made the writing feel more like an obligation. Fortunately, at that level of success, you could write without a contract and reasonably expect to get published. I couldn't recommend that. You know, that's the way to go for an awful lot of people. You may not know that P.D. James never had a contract. She wrote all of her books and then turned them in, you know. So I think that, you know, that might be a new publishing model, actually, the way publishing is going in its weird ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, who knows?
Jacob.
Sherry asks, oh, this is a good one. Do you read your own reviews?
Oh,
yes
don't sound so sad about it.
I'll just quickly say, I was gonna say, so when my book is before it publishes and when it first goes out, you know, the arcs go out, I'm on Goodreads 30 times a day, and because I want to know those first, I'm just like, oh my god, what does everyone think? You're just so desperate for feedback. And then it reaches critical mass and you get a few one stars. You're like, okay, this is not a place for me anymore. So I do to a point and then I stop looking. So I think it's just that wanting feedback at the very beginning where I really am, you know, no one's really read it except a few beta readers and my editor. So I want to know, what do readers think? And then I'm like, okay, now you guys have at it. Cause I don't know if we're really supposed to be looking. If you know what I
do,
you know,
I pretty much do the same thing. I look in the beginning because you've been bottled up with this book for so long and finally it's going out to some readers, and I will always look at the first ones and then eventually stop. I don't read every single one after that, but the first ones that come in is like your first outside feedback.
Yes, exactly.
Kind of a concomitant question, Samantha, are you ever surprised by, not by criticism, but by things readers saw in the book that, you know, surprised you?
Oh, definitely. I'm often surprised just by how somebody interprets something that I wrote, and they just have a completely different view of it. And I meant, you know, for this person to be good and they hate that person, or I meant for this to be funny and they thought it was sad. I mean, it's funny how different people see things completely differently. I think that's the importance of having beta readers. I have a critique group, and even though I've worked with them for a long time, they take things totally differently than I mean them sometimes. And I think, wow, I really didn't get that across well, because you're interpreting it in a totally different way than I meant it. It's amazing how that happens.
Yeah, I love, sometimes I'll get a review and it'll say something like very, you know, like, she subverts cliches in this book, and I'm like, yes I did. No, I have no idea I'm doing, you know, like they'll turn it into something a lot deeper, which I appreciate, because I wasn't consciously doing it. So I love sometimes when you'll get a review like from a newspaper or you know, Publishers Weekly or what have you, and they, you know, see something more literary than you were thinking at the time, and I always appreciate that.
Having presided over thousands of live book events, I can tell you that the one thing I know for sure is that every reader reads a book differently. And, you know, I'm always fascinated by their reactions, and now the author, I can tell visibly sitting next to me, is also equally surprised and fascinated by how it comes out. But, you know, that's true. I mean, every book that's published and goes out in the world assumes a life of its own with whoever the reader is. You can't make it clear for every reader. It's not possible.
No, I think once it's out in the world, it's not really your book anymore. It's the reader's book.
Yeah, no, indeed so. Jacob, anything else?
Yeah, we have one more. Do either of you have any advice for beginning writers?
I think I would just say what I said before. First, you have to love to actually write. And if it's a chore to sit down and write, then it's probably not for you. So keep writing, work on the craft, and whatever genre you want to be in, read your genre. Know what's out there, know how it's being done, know what's been done before. You really need to know your genre inside and out to write in that genre.
And I would just add to that, I always really encourage people to finish their work, even if they get discouraged and go, oh, this is too similar to that, or, you know, this isn't the idea now, I'm going to go off and start something else. I used to be the worst offender for starting things and not finishing them. And it wasn't until I finished a full novel that I really understood what it takes to write a full novel, what a story does, the arc of a story over 300 odd pages. And, you know, I learned so much from actually completing something, whether it goes anywhere or not. So, you know, you can write a lot of first acts, but until you write three acts, you're not really telling a full story. So I think it's very valuable to do that.
I would say persevere. You know, you should have faith in yourself. And there are many, many authors who can list their, you know, dozens or hundreds of rejections before they wrote whatever book it was that, you know, did well or got published. Yeah. So if you can't stay the course, that's the other thing. You really should, you know, do something else. Well, fortunately, that did not happen with the two authors that we've been talking to this evening. So here we are. So Samantha's beautiful book, A Twisted Love Story, out last Tuesday. So on sale now at your favorite bookstore, including The Poison Pen. And Robin's book, here we go, The Drowning Woman. You could almost read this as social history, in a way, of where we are at the moment. I mean, it's a great story. But honestly, there are elements of it that I think really, if any of you read Nickel and Dimed in America by Barbara Erickson, wasn't that her name? Barbara somebody. Anyway, this is a compulsive version of what it would be like to work at Walmart and, you know, try to scrape up money for a hotel and end up sleeping in your car. That's not what the story is, but that's the background for the story. And I found it really arresting, given our present circumstances. In Phoenix, we are cleaning up the homeless camp called the what's it called, Jacob? The district, the camp, what's it called?
No.
I think it's the district. Anyway, and it's a hugely controversial project, you know, because property owners and all kinds of people on one side are saying, you know, we just can't let this go on. And on the other side, the question is, you know, what will happen to these people if we do get them off the street? And those who don't want to go. And I think it's a really challenging, maybe the biggest challenge facing certainly urban areas or even rural areas for that matter at the moment. Not just in America, but all over. So that's all I'm going to say, except that I really love these two books and I hope you will too. And we made it through without anybody getting kicked off except briefly for Samantha. So the little monsoon is over. So thank you very much, ladies. It was a real pleasure to spend time with you and you. Enjoy the rest of your week. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you so much.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.